Blog Talk Radio.
Well, you may throw your rock, hide your hand, working in the dark against your fellow man. But as sure as God made black and white, what's done in the dark will be brought to the light. You can run on for a long time, run on for a long time, run on for a long time. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Sooner or later, gotta cut you down. Go tell that long-tongued liar, go and tell that midnight rider, tell the rambler, the gambler, the backbiter, tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down. Tell him that God's gonna cut you down.
Hey, Terry, this is Kirk. I can't hear you if you're talking. Now, Terry, apparently you can hear me, but I can't hear you at all. Will do. I'll call right back in. Yeah, Terry, I'm sorry. I guess I have a live mic, and the audience can probably hear me. You can hear, but I can't hear you for some reason. And it's strange because I could hear the show's music as it started the show, so I was hearing. I just can't hear you. Well, listen, I'm going to go ahead. Terry has indicated that he's going to try and call back in his end. So at the moment, I can't hear Terry, and he's asked me to go ahead and get started. So I guess we have an audience, hopefully, that's able to hear what I'm talking about. We're going to be addressing a couple of different topics tonight, and I think that the first one we'll start with is the unconstitutional United States. Just a second here. And I still can't hear anything, but I'm going to continue talking here for a while until Terry, you say different. So the issue here really gets down to, I think, the point I guess I want to raise is something that I raised when I was doing some presentations on jurisdiction and talking about really how the federal government doesn't have the authority that's exercised over, you know, over land, over people, over everything. And in the course of doing that kind of analysis and talking to people, learning from others, there was a Supreme Court decision that I came across. And this, I think, is really the crux of a concern that I have here, and it really addresses a lot of everything. The Supreme Court decision was in 1945, and if the audience doesn't know that, it's Hooven and Allison Company versus Evatt, 324 U.S. 652. And here's what this remarkable thing does, because it gets down to a question of what is the United States? Now, we use that term a lot. We talk about it a lot. We refer to, you know, United States laws, laws of the United States, Supreme Court decisions, United States Supreme Court decisions, and so forth. And we assume that that basically means the thing that we think that it means. It means our federation, if you will. It means the 50 states in a union working together. And in this Supreme Court decision, I'm going to read you this particular quote. It says, the term United States may be used in any one of several senses. It may merely be the name of a sovereign occupying a position analogous to that of other sovereigns in the family of nations. Whoa. Where did that come from? You know, our country is founded on the basis that the people are their sovereigns. So all of a sudden they're saying, wait a minute, the United States, one of its definitions is it's a sovereign analogous to being a sovereign in the family of nations. Then the next sentence, it may designate the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. Well, that's interesting. It's saying over the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends, or it may be the collective name of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. The third one is the one that I think that most of us actually relate to. Now, Terry, are you on yet?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can.
Good. I called it on my cell phone.
Well, you go ahead and jump in, or you want me to just continue?
No, continue right on. You're doing fine. The only thing you didn't do is didn't tell any of our listeners about yourself, but go ahead and finish your thought for...
Okay. So... It may be the collective name of the states which are united by and under the Constitution. So now we have three different definitions for the United States referring to it's a sovereign or the territory over which its sovereignty extends, or what we would think of as being the United States being the states that actually comprise our federation. Not a nation. We're not a nation. We are a federation. So I think that digging a little further here, really need to understand what all this really means. And what they're saying is that there is, let's take it, the first one being the one that we understand, it's the 50 states working together in a union. Then it talks about the territory over which the sovereignty of the United States extends. Now, if you're not familiar with these, you might say, well, gee, it extends over the entire country, you know, all of our land and so forth. And, in fact, that's not the case. In the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 is very specific. It says what is the jurisdiction, if you will, the legislative authority that the federal government has over land. And it's basically clear. It has the first thing it says is it gets to basically Washington, what's now known as Washington, D.C., 10 square miles for the seat of the government. And that's with the concession of the states that would give up that land for that purpose. And the key word here is exclusive legislative authority. The next one is that they say that, and lands that they basically acquire from the states with the consent of the states involved for enumerated purposes. And that's really an important thing. It's not just a carte blanche they can have land, but it's for enumerated purposes. And those essentially are the forts, arsenals, dockyards, and other needful buildings. That's it. That's it. And in 1962, the Eisenhower Report, started during the Eisenhower administration and published, goes through and exhaustively lists all the land in the United States and defines what the jurisdiction of the federal government is. And Category 1, which is this equivalent to the constitutional authority that it has, is the exclusive jurisdiction, is in fact a very teeny fraction of 1% of our nation's land. It's basically they had the right to have exclusive legislative authority over areas that had to do with our security. Category 4, although it doesn't, it's kind of hard to understand, the federal government always writes from its perspective, not from the people's perspective, but what it's basically saying is the states retain all of the legislative authority over those lands. That's something like 95% of all this land that we think belongs to the federal government, in fact, is under the exclusive legislative authority of the states. Now, the importance of legislative authority is that Article 1 of the Constitution talks about the legislature and the laws. And the reason it starts with that is because that's what gives the federal government its authority, is its legislative authority. The executive is there to enforce that legislation. The judicial is there to make sure that it fits within constitutional boundaries. But their government has no authority that doesn't come through its legislative, with the exception of some things that we'll talk about in Article 4, which have to do with lands that are not yet states, essentially what's called the territories. So the laws that are applied by the federal government that pertain to its jurisdiction really only pertains to a teeny little fraction of our land, not the entire country. And in that, they consider the federal government, if you will, to almost have national status, because basically what they're saying is that where we have exclusive legislative authority, then we are the only authority. Now, here's the next part of this same Supreme Court decision. It absolutely is staggering. It is no longer doubted that the United States may acquire territory by conquest or by treaty, and may govern it through the exercise of the power of Congress conferred by 3 of Article 4 of the Constitution, to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. In exercising this power, Congress is not subject to the same constitutional limitations as when it is legislating for the United States. And in general, the guarantees of the Constitution extend them only as Congress has made those guarantees applicable. Whoa, back up the track. What did they just tell us? I'm going to use the term the federal zone. Essentially, the Constitution has defined some land that's the federal zone, teeny fraction of land in which the federal government has exclusive legislative authority. What this Supreme Court decision is saying is that that exclusive legislative authority is no longer accountable to any rest of the Constitution or the Bill of Rights. That essentially it's constitutional to be unconstitutional. They can do whatever they want inside of the federal zone as to legislation with no consequence to think about the Constitution. Now, if you look at the original aim of the Constitution as written in the document, most people, if I ask them what's the full name of the Constitution, they say Constitution of the United States of America. That's wrong. Go look it up. It's the Constitution for the United States of America. There's a big difference. And when you start playing around trying to understand the manipulations that are going on, it's just like Bill Clinton's definition of, you know, what is the word is. They play games with the little words. The Constitution for was a Constitution written by the people for the central entity that we are creating. That is the one that pertains to the 50 states as a confederation. The Constitution of the United States, in my opinion, is now referring to the same document, but they're saying, but it's the Constitution of the government for itself, and is subject to legislative change. In other words, in international law, when you invade a country and take it over, the general international consideration is that the constitution of that particular nation exists and continues to exist, but only to the extent you haven't changed it. As soon as you start putting in legislation, you don't have to actually say it's an amendment to the Constitution. It's automatically overriding the Constitution. And that is what they're saying in this legal decision that's okay for the federal government to do. Within the federal zone, the Constitution really is no longer a Constitution. It's something that can be changed. And as they pass legislation like the Civil Rights Act, which overrides inalienable rights, they're saying that's hunky-dory. This is a fundamental corruption in the entire process, and it pervades everything that follows. Now, Terry, you want me to take a break so you can jump in, or you want me to keep going?
No, we're fine. I think this is good. This is basically affirming some of the things that we've talked about in months past, and this is right on. I mean, the information that you're providing here is perfect, and just keep right on going.
Okay. So let's understand where we sit at this point in time. Congress wears two hats. You know, there's the Organic Act of 1871, you know, forms of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. Some people think that meant turn it into a corporation. I disagree with that viewpoint. But in any case, you know, it's exercising legislation over the land that it controls directly. That's called municipal law. That's the word for that. When a nation passes or a country or a government passes laws that pertain to within its jurisdiction, that's municipal law as versus international law. So Congress has two hats. On the one hand, it's passing laws that are municipal in nature that only pertain to the federal zone. And on the other hand, it's passing what I will call general laws or international laws, essentially laws that fall under the Constitution that govern generally. Here's the problem. It's the same Congress. And they describe them both as United States laws. And that we only have one Federal Register. We only have one U.S. Code. We only have one Code of Federal Regulations. We only have one set of courts. And they're all sitting there calling themselves the United States. But in fact, they're actually doing two very different things. And you have to understand, we have to understand when they're doing one versus the other, because you can't tell. They've decided that they're going to use the word United States for both purposes. Now, shortly after the Supreme Court made that decision, here's the next corruption that happens in the process. The Supreme Court was never to be the lawmaker in this country. And now it seems to be general knowledge they make the law. That's not the case. But that Supreme Court decision of Hooven went right into Black's Law Dictionary. If you looked up the definition of the United States, it'll say verbatim exactly what I read you from that Supreme Court decision. That is until they removed the definition from a later edition of Black's Law, and you'll no longer even find it in Black's Law. You won't even have a clue. Our attorneys and people who go through and get their degrees and start practicing law will have no idea that the United States actually means three different things, and that there's this intentional deception going on. Because I believe that a lot of what the government is passing in terms of laws, for example, environmental laws, the Endangered Species Act, National Environmental Policy Act, Equal Access to Justice Act, they really only pertain to the federal zone. And yet we are led to believe that they pertain to the entire lands of the country. So the interesting part is, if you take a look at other Supreme Court decisions, for example, Norris versus Baltimore, not a Supreme Court decision, but a decision, where the meaning of the Constitution is clear and unambiguous, there can be no resort to construction to attribute to the founders a purpose or intent not manifest in a letter. But isn't that exactly what the Supreme Court's doing? Or United States versus Class, 313, 299, 1941. The courts cannot rightly prefer of the possible meanings of the words of the Constitution that which will defeat rather than effectuate the constitutional purpose. And yet it does. Or another decision, Amos versus Mosley. If the legislature clearly misinterprets a constitutional provision, the frequent repetition of the wrong will not create a right. Or Mueller versus Oregon, 208 U.S. 412. It is the peculiar value of a written constitution that it places in unchanging form limitations upon the legislation and thus gives a permanence and stability to popular government which otherwise would be lacking. And finally, Urban versus Collins, Florida, 85S852. The Constitution is an instrument from the people and a construction thereof. In other words, how you interpret the words. A construction thereof should effectuate their purpose from the words employed in the document, and that courts may not color it by the addition of words or the engrafting of their views as to how it should be written. So we have a situation today where, in my opinion, and I have believed this for some time, the Supreme, and I'm sure most of you believe the same thing, is the Supreme Court is a corrupt part of the federal government. And it's basically being treated as if it sets the laws of land. Nine people in Halloween costumes are supposed to determine the laws of 350 million people. Now, if we take a look, what is the implication of having three different definitions for the United States have to do with how we in the movement read Supreme Court decisions and understand what they truly mean? So let's go back to the Hooven decision, and let's reread this thing. It is no longer doubted that, and I'm going to, I'll read it from beginning to end. It is no longer doubted that the United States may acquire territory by conquest or by treaty. Now, is it referring to the United States as a federal zone, as a sovereign, or are we talking about the states united? And may govern it through the exercise of the power of Congress conferred by Article 3 of Article 4 of the Constitution to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or other property belonging to the United States. In exercising this power, Congress is not subject to the same constitutional limitations as when it is legislating for the United States. So here we have three different uses of the word United States. In one paragraph, do they all mean one thing? Because if so, then we can look at the third part of this and clearly understand that one. It says, in exercising this power, Congress is not subject to the same constitutional limitations as when it's legislating for the United States. But we know that means what I think a lot of people in the movement call the de jure United States, the 50 states and union. That one's clear. We can tell from the context. Are we then to say, okay, well, since that's the definition used there, is that the same definition when it says the United States may acquire territory by conquest or by treaty? In other words, the lands that are obtained by conquest or by treaty belong to the people of large of the United States, or they belong in general, or do they belong to the federal zone? Because we know what the Supreme Court has interpreted. We have people, you know, Puerto Rico and so forth, that have been determined to be properties not of the states and union, but of the federal zone. And then when it goes on and says to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory or the property belonging to the United States, here again. So it's quite possible that what's intended here is within one paragraph, the three different uses of the word United States all are given either two or three different meanings. Because if it only means one thing, I would actually agree with this decision. It belongs to us, we the people. It doesn't belong to the federal zone. But I think that they're playing a game with us here, and it's a very serious game. Now, how does this pertain to sovereignty? There's another decision, Prince versus United States. This is the one Sheriff Richard Mack is known for. This is actually, Prince was in Ravalli County, Montana, that I visited last year and I made some presentations to, and I'll be back up there again this year. And here's a part of this Supreme Court decision. The federal government may neither issue directives requiring the states to address particular problems nor command the state's officers. Okay, so it was previously understood the federal government may neither issue the directives. They can't tell the states what to do. But isn't that what they're doing? In fact, to some degree. Nor, and this was a decision that was critical in Prince, command the state's officers. They can't bypass the state governments and go directly to the state's officers and tell them what to do. Such commands are fundamentally incompatible with our constitutional system of dual sovereignty.
And there you hear the word dual sovereignty. Notice, here again, referring to the federal zone, the federal government as a sovereign. I believe that this is where, in reality, for those who understand things like the fringe on the flag, no fringe, you know, this idea of a corporate United States, I actually believe what we have here is a government that has decided to become unleashed with respect to the federal zone. It's defeated the Constitution, and it's acting without any constraint, and therefore the laws that pass, it doesn't matter whether you believe in, they're saying it's admiralty law, it's UCC code, you know, whatever else, because the bottom line, it's all of the above. You're all right. Everybody in the movement's right, because there is no limitation on the laws that they can pass under the federal zone under this interpretation. They're only constrained when they're passing general laws that apply to the all of the states at large. Now, so the original Constitution says tiny bit of land, that's it. There is no direct legislative authority over the federal government over people. Very important to understand that people were to be citizens of their states. There is to be no direct relationship between the people and the federal government. That's how we created it. But when the 14th Amendment comes around, guess what happens? The first clause, and this is Corey et al. Versus Carter, 48 Indiana, 327, 1874. The first clause of the 14th Amendment made Negroes citizens of the United States. Guess what? The 14th Amendment is interpreted to mean that the Negroes have now become citizens of the federal zone. The federal zone now includes people and citizens of the state in which they reside. Dual citizenship, is that not interesting? And thereby created two classes of citizens, one of the United States, referring to the federal government, the federal zone, and the other of the state. Now, the 14th Amendment, to kind of get back to that one, like the 15th Amendment, like the 13th Amendment, the last little clause says, and basically this amendment is going to be overseen by Congress. What that has done is said that basically Congress's legislative authority has now been extended to cover people. That's the interpretation. And then the interpretation of the Spanish-American War, when we went to war as a nation, the lands that were conquered did not become lands of us, the general people, under their interpretation. They became property of the federal zone. So now what happened is Guam and Samoa and Puerto Rico and all the people that were in them, they now become essentially slaves to the federal government, along with the Negroes. So what has happened is now the federal government no longer is limited to getting income simply from, you know, import duties. It can tax the people. It's beginning to expand the federal zone. And I think that what we're seeing is that now through the ambiguity, our not understanding the word United States, they have now extended the term United States laws and so forth, have led us to believe that this central entity, therefore, has the total control over all land, all people, all corporations, the whole schmoly. And that's where we are today. And we're sitting there, and, you know, people in this movement reading the Supreme Court decisions, giving them false interpretations because they really don't understand what some of the words mean, like what is the United States. Now, here's another decision I'm going to – go ahead, Terry. I'll stop.
Before you get into that one, I hope you can keep your place. Put a placeholder there. We've got a question in the chat room. Would like for you to again explain the difference between of the United States versus for the United States, and why that one word change. What was the difference? What difference did it make?
Because and they're not going to tell you what difference it makes, but it actually does make a difference. When you say for, it's a constitution for the government you're creating. Well, who created it? Well, it's very clear from Supreme Court decisions back in those days when it was honest and for all the founding documents, we the people were the sovereigns, and we created a constitution for this central entity that we were going to create, not to control us, but to protect us. So it was from the people for the government we are creating. But when you say Constitution of the United States, what you're saying, it's the Constitution that belongs to the federal zone. It's the Constitution the United States government has created for itself, which is subject now to legislative change. Did I answer that question clearly?
Very clearly, and I hope that satisfied our listener that asked that question. It's also they're also asking, didn't the government do the same dual citizenship for the American Indians? In essence, I don't know if that's really in the category of what you're talking about, but I'll let you address it.
Well, it's actually true. I mean, basically what they're saying is that and now it's even getting worse because they're now using the tribes, just like, you know, this nation, I don't know how many are old enough to remember, you know, gambling was absolutely forbidden. I mean, you didn't even, you know, you weren't supposed to gamble with your family, you know, on holidays or anything. I mean, there certainly wasn't, you know, slot machines and all that kind of stuff. You know, people who may have been born after that never knew that. You know, for 2,000 years, because of our Christian roots, you know, gambling wasn't legal to do. And the way they got that started with Bugsy Siegel was they went and they came up with a scheme, and then they went and took it over to the Indian tribes. It wasn't the Indians that came up with this idea. It was these guys, the money guys from New York City, from the East Coast. And then what happens is they're now doing the same thing with our, quote, national lands. They're now using the same thing with the Native quote, the Native Americans, to basically say, well, if they have rights to fish salmon, that means they have control over all the water that flows through all the, you know, all the rivers and streams that might go through their particular reservation from snowdrop to, you know, raindrop. Therefore, they control the entire water basin. This is happening nationwide. When I first came across this in Siskiyou County with the Klamath River dams, I thought that that whole thing with the Crook tribe was a unique thing, and I'm finding out, no. These same East Coast shysters are using the tribes once again, but the tribes themselves fall under the Bureau of Indian Affairs, and they have been treated in a different category from the rest of us. So they're kind of like, they're almost, now what's happening, they want to call them nations on an equal standing. Well, in terms of nations, when you get the environmental laws, then there's some actually, you know, 50 miles, 100 miles, whatever it is, you know, a nation has a right to protect itself from environmental impact from the nation adjacent to it. So well, there's all these things that come along with that. Now they're also using that to also say that the tribes then therefore control entire massive areas of our states because they're getting affected by the things that come through their lands. So, but they in reality fall under the federal government. And so they, one way or another, bottom line, through the Bureau of Indian Affairs, they have a kind of a different, distinct status, but they're still citizens of the, quote, of the federal government. And I think that is a correct interpretation. Now, this dual citizenship thing needs to be really recognized, and I'm going to read a couple more Supreme Court decisions to cement that. Slaughterhouse cases, 83 U.S. 36. 1873. You know, if you want to find the real, you know, the real meaning of the Constitution and so forth, you go back to the 1800s. You don't do anything in the 1900s, certainly not after 1913. It is quite clear, then, that there is a citizenship of the United States and a citizenship of a state which are distinct from each other. And then U.S. versus Cruikshank, 92 U.S. 542 in 1875. We have in our political system a government of the United States and a government of each of the several states. You follow me there? Each one of these governments is distinct from the others, and each has citizens of its own. I think the 14th Amendment, you know, the 14th, 15th, 16th, Federal Reserve Act, I mean, these essentially were a revolution. They really have changed everything. The more I get into this 14th Amendment, the more I'm beginning to really appreciate just how, given the interpretations that are given to it these days, just how much our country was essentially overthrown. What many people may not realize is the nature by which it came into existence. It was not ratified. It was not ratified, and there's a snippet. There's about a three-minute part of a presentation in one of my videos that animates what I'm about to say. And you may want to look at that. In the 13th Amendment, at the end of the Civil War, the states have pretty much been come back in the fold. They were some presidential. The president there had said, okay, you're back in the fold again. This is Andrew Johnson after the assassination of Lincoln. And the 13th Amendment is passed, and it only passes because a lot of the southern states agree with that. That's the one that ends slavery, so they voted for that. When the 14th Amendment came around, a number of them said no. 15 states rejected it, including a number of those states that actually voted for the 13th, that ratified the 13th. The states that rejected included Texas, was first, October 17, 1866, Georgia, Florida, Alabama, North Carolina, Arkansas, South Carolina, Kentucky, Virginia, Ohio, Mississippi, Louisiana, Delaware, Maryland, and New Jersey. And this unfolded over a period of about a five-month period.
And there was a few others that only approved it by way of gunpoint or duress.
Not quite. We're not quite there yet. Congress, the radical Republicans, essentially take over the government, and they pass a series of Reconstruction Acts that start to change things. And these are all passed over the veto of President Andrew Johnson. Remember, Johnson is the one that was the first one to be impeached, and it was because he was standing for the Constitution. And what the Reconstruction Acts do in effect was they took 10 of these states and they put them under military rule. They denied them representation in Congress when the representatives showed up and they didn't seat them. They removed the democratically elected legislators with military force, and they replaced them by rump legislators. And I think, from what I understand, most of them were actually formerly slaves that had been freed, were said, here, go vote for this. That's out of the deal. So under the force of military threat, these states were forced to, one, change their constitutions, two, elect legislators that were suitable to the military occupation, and ratify the 14th Amendment. That's the situation that went on. The federal citizens of the federal zone then, by definition, have no constitutional protections or inalienable rights. All they have are what's called civil rights, and that's all you hear in the news today. And they're really not rights. They're privileges. These are the privileges that the federal government can create or change at a moment's notice. And if you notice what's really happening here, why don't we have free speech anymore? Because, well, you might offend somebody. What is that alleged to be? That's a civil right. But that, what they're saying is that civil right is superior to your inalienable right to have free speech. And if you really understand what's going on here, the Civil Rights Act is the one that is destroying this country, and that in combination with what I call the Affirmative Discrimination Act, the whole thing is biased against the original Americans, and we're now seeing that whole thing come to fruition with the invasion of our country that's going to, if continued, will permanently change the demographics in this country. We will be defeated. These are basically then privileges granted by whatever type of law the federal government wants to pass. Negroes are essentially not freed. They went from being chattel property of the slave owners to being property of the federal nation. And like I said before, the federal nation then grew its tax base. It did this first by absorbing the Negroes. It then passed the Civil Rights Act, the first one, 1871. It then did it with the U.S. possessions, where we took land from the Spanish. That's 1898, 1899. Then the alleged passage of the 16th Amendment, which Red knows all about, which is not passed and doesn't mean what we think it means, but allegedly brings into bearing a federal income tax. And then, of course, Social Security in 1935. All of these things are essentially extending to absorb everything and everybody into the federal zone in a non-constitutional environment. Now, here's a quote I've not been able to completely verify this, but I guarantee this sounds to me so right. I'm going to read you the whole thing because I think it really talks to you. How do they get you pulled into the federal zone? Because the 14th Amendment does not make non-Negroes automatic citizens of the United States in this way. And here's the answer. Okay, here's a quote that allegedly was being made by Edward Mandel House. He used to go by Colonel, which was a ruse. He was never in the military. He didn't have that title. I notice nowadays they've dropped it off. They don't refer to him that way. But he was the guy that was assigned by J.P. Morgan to sit on top of Woodrow Wilson's right arm and make sure that Wilson did everything that the globalists wanted, including trying to get the League of Nations and get us into war immediately after the Federal Reserve. It's not an accident that the World War I begins immediately after the Federal Reserve Act, because now they have the mechanism to actually finance the war. And so he's the guy who writes the book, Philip Droop Administrator, who talks about all-powerful administrators. Well, that should sound familiar to a lot of people who feel themselves under the thumb of the administration, executive orders, you know, regulations, harsh fines, and so forth. That's all comes from this guy. So how do they get you pulled into the federal zone? And this is one of the mechanisms. So this is the quote. Very soon, every American will be required to register their biological property, in other words, our bodies, in a national system designed to keep track of the people and that will operate under the ancient system of pledging. Pledging is just indentured servitude. By such methodology, we can compel people to submit to our agenda, which will affect our security as a chargeback for our fiat paper currency. Now, notice how everything is coming together here, because now you can see the thumbprint of the international bankers here. What they're saying is that this system is going to pull them into the federal zone and become essentially indentured servants to pay off the debts being incurred by the federal government, because we now, quote, fall in the federal zone. So it will affect, in other words, it will guarantee our security as a chargeback for our fiat paper currency, which, as we all know, is valueless. Every American will be forced to register or suffer being unable to work and earn a living. They will be our chattel. Remember, like chattel is the same thing as chattel slavery? And we will hold the security interest over them forever by operation of the law merchant under the scheme of secured transactions. Now, the law merchant is the merchant law, the admiralty law. That is the law that governs ships and trades, and the trade has always been the bankers. That's how they got into actually doing money. They originally were traders. That's how they got into it. So all these pieces, all their system of pledging, their law merchant, all of that's going to be pulled into their system. Americans, by unknowingly or unwittingly delivering the bills of lading to us, will be rendered bankrupt and insolvent, forever to remain economic slaves through taxation secured by their pledges. They will be stripped of their rights and given a commercial value designed to make us a profit, and they will be none the wiser, for not one man in a million could ever figure out our plans. If by accident one or two should figure it out, we have in our arsenal plausible deniability. After all, this is the only logical way to fund government, by floating liens and debt to the registrants in the form of benefits and privileges. This will inevitably reap to us huge profits beyond our wildest expectations and leave every American a contributor to this fraud, which we will call social insurance. Without realizing it, every American will insure us for any loss we may incur, and in this matter, every American will unknowingly be our servant, however begrudgingly. The people will become helpless and without any hope for their redemption, and we will employ the high office of the president of our dummy corporation to foment this plot against America. I've not been able to, like I said, find the original work in which that's quoted, but I can tell you for everything I've studied about this man, and it's a lot, and this whole system and everything he refers to, this thing to me is absolutely, whether he said it or not, I think this is dead on. This is exactly what's going on here. Now, there's one part of this I wanted to come back to. Uh,
You've probably heard the works of Bruce Ray Riggs, who I met back in 2009 and persuaded to actually attend the Continental Congress. And then things kind of fell apart for him there because he got hooked in with some people who were, I felt, were disingenuous and were, to some extent, provocateurs. But he has continued to bring forward what happened during the Civil War and Reconstruction. And one of the things that he brought out was the fact that when the Southern states walked out, the Congress lost its quorum and was thus disbanded, if you will, because during that time period, Lincoln actually ceased to be a constitutional president. And there was a lot of things that proceeded from that point forward. And when they put the 14th into place, along with that Act of 1871, which is a real jewel, it seems that we've never really properly ceded a constitutional government from that time forward. Is that what your research has revealed?
Well, I think that there's probably some truth to that. You know, eventually they did have, you know, people elected by all the states that are representing us theoretically and so forth in Congress. So I won't necessarily go that far myself, but I will definitely say that the path from there to here has not been constitutional and therefore, in my opinion, is not all valid. I think the 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment, the 16th Amendment, the Federal Reserve Act, all of those are unconstitutional. They have not been passed constitutionally. But I want to come back, Terry, to this, a couple things I saw when I was reading this, some words I want to be clear on this. They will be our chattel. Now, I want to go back in 1861, I think it is, Terry, you'll probably remember if it's not, the Hazard Circular. This precedes the Civil War. And essentially the bankers at that point in time in London, and this was pointed out, there was a Hazard Circular and then there was a article written about it that essentially said that we've got to stop these Americans because they're issuing paper currency without any debt. At that time, our currency was gold and silver, no debt, and then when they started issuing paper, it was at least guaranteed and backed by silver and gold, and it was not only printed by the federal government, it was issued by the federal government by paying its bills. They never had to borrow that money. They just created money. And they said,
it was the greenbacks that got Lincoln killed.
There's three different types of greenbacks, but let me go back to my main point. The Hazard Circular says we got to stop this because if they're able to actually go ahead and create a debt-free currency, they're going to wipe us out. They basically put in the phrase in context, we'll wipe out all the monarchs. Of course, they didn't care about the monarchs. They cared about the bankers. And so they essentially declared war, and I think there's a pretty good case to be made that it was the Rothschilds who fomented the Civil War. I think that we've seen blockades been used to create wars and try and look like you're not the aggressor, but in fact, you know, blockaded Japan, which resulted in Pearl Harbor, the blockades that were done during the Civil War of the Charleston Harbor, which was preventing the southern states from conducting trade internationally and so forth, and others, you'll find this going on. I have a feeling that was intentionally done, and it's actually interesting that was the seed of the Illuminati. But in any case, they will be our chattel. So what they're now doing is reconstructed a new system that doesn't look to us like slavery, but in fact it does the same thing. And the other part of this thing I want to read here is every American will be forced to register or suffer being unable to work and earn a living. Now, why is that? Because corporations are the creatures of the 14th Amendment. The word person is supposed to now mean people and legal fiction, something that doesn't exist in real reality. It's just something the law says it's okay to exist, which is a corporation or partner, things that are similar to that. And what they're saying, and what they've, corporations being a creature then of the 14th Amendment, they're part of the federal zone. And they can't hire you unless you have a Social Security number. They won't. You can go in there all day long and say, hey, I'm a sovereign. And they say, well, if you don't have a Social Security number, that's because they're governed by a set of laws. And those laws say that they won't hire you. So this is, I think, what's being referred to in this statement. You'll be forced to register or suffer being unable to work and earn a living. Now, you can work and you can earn a living, but you're going to have to do it without joining a corporation. I think that the
Can I contribute something
Well, let me just
there?
Make one closing remark, and then let's open it up, Terry.
Okay.
So what is the United States under their definition? You know, I believe what it is, as they interpret it, is it's a renegade government. It's occupied and it's hostile. It believes that it's in control, and that's its nature, and that's its purposes, and it's absolutely, totally unconstrained. And the Supreme Court, in my opinion, is in great times where they make statements like, well, you can pass Obamacare because it's a tax. They're not referring to the Constitution. They're referring to the federal zone laws and saying, I believe that that's what's going on here. And I think that even perhaps some of the attorneys that present to the Supreme Court don't even realize the ruse that's going on. So with that, Terry, let me go ahead and stop and turn it back over to you.
Well, you know, there's several different things and ways that they've accomplished this, and I think Ron McDonald's thinking is good. I believe that the guy Weiss, Adele Weiss, what he has to say is good, and I believe that what Joe Bannister has to say is good, and they don't all exactly line up with each other, but I think they're all true, because I think that they've accomplished what you're talking about, what you've described. You've given one avenue toward it, and I'm saying that there are multiple avenues to accomplish their purpose, so they've kind of covered themselves. Ron McDonald says that the Federal Reserve notes are a foreign product owned by a foreign corporation, and because we conduct all of our business with that, then that justifies bringing admiralty, the law of merchants, into our courts and puts an invisible lien on each and every one of us and everything that we purchase and sell, because we are using this foreign debt note owned by a foreign corporation in order to transact that business. I believe that that's true. Now, Adele Weiss talks about the fact that we're born as American nationals, as citizens of our state. We are also an American national. And that when we first file a 1040 form, which basically is volunteering to be subject to that corporate entity that controls the 10 square miles and has now usurped outside of that jurisdiction, but every time we file a 1040, we are acknowledging and admitting that we are a U.S. citizen, not being a citizen of our state, but by their terminology, that means we are subject to and therefore taxable by that entity that has taken occupancy of our capital, of our federation capital. Bannister, on the other hand, when I talked to him about this concept of the 1040s, he didn't disagree with it, except that he said in order to you can't just revoke your election like Adele Weiss says. Adele Weiss says if you revoke your election, and if you read in the tax code, it's very specific that if you elect to revoke your election to be a U.S. citizen, as you have done by filing a 1040, the tax code says not that you may not file another 1040. It says you cannot file another 1040. It says you'll never be able to file one again. So if you elect to revoke your election, then you are removed as a U.S. citizen, which means only not that you're born within the states, but that you are subject to that corporation and therefore taxable by. Bannister says if you do that, you will raise a red flag to the police state, and they're still going to harass you as long as you are accepting 1099 or W-2 income. So he says remove the flag, and they'll leave you alone anyway, whether you've revoked your election or not. So here we are in really a police state condition with people not really realizing what it means truly to be a U.S. citizen at all. They believe that it means some kind of patriotic thing that makes you something that you were born as, and in fact, it's not that at all. We were not born U.S. citizens. We were born citizens of our state, and only by election, by voluntary election, do we volunteer to be a U.S. citizen and thereby become subject to that usurping corporation over there in D.C.
The part of this that I don't want to go down the tax path and make that the topic tonight, Terry, but I think that the part that I agree with you with is that there's multiple avenues to, quote, volunteer yourself to be part of the federal zone, and they are, even though it's all deception and fraudulent, they are taking the tactic that you have voluntarily chosen to do this, whether it's Social Security, it's opening up an interest-bearing bank account, filing a tax return. All these things they're saying, these are voluntary things whereby you're submitting yourself. I don't want to get into all the details of all that. I do believe that what I've laid out, though, I don't believe in this corporate United States, but I do believe that there is a federal zone that they're saying it's constitutional to be unconstitutional, and I do agree it's adopted a corporate face to it. For example, they call the Federal Reserve System a kind of an independent agency. Now, there's an oxymoron. Essentially, it's a corporation, but it's a corporate face to the federal zone, and they've done the same thing, for example, the post office. So I would agree that there's a corporate face, but I don't necessarily agree with the movement. But I do believe what I've laid out here, which is actually backed up by Supreme Court decisions, is actually the correct path to understand this thing, that they're essentially saying that there's three United States, and some would even argue there's a fourth definition as well. This is the only thing I want to convey in this part of our presentation, frankly, is to wake and peek up to the fact that there is a huge fraud, that those that are studying Supreme Court decisions, including, the people in the movement, state legislatures, even attorneys that are studying this stuff and so forth, are really not correctly interpreting them, nor do they understand the jurisdiction of the court that's operating, because mostly I do agree with that they're on this kind of administrative side. They're essentially on this unconstitutional federal zone side. That's what most of the courts are actually operating under. It gets into legal fictions and all that kind of stuff, and your straw man, all that. But I don't want to get back into that, but I just want to convey this fact. All this stuff kind of goes together. There's all these facets. They all kind of come to one place. But I want to convey this particular part of it in this citizenship in this three United States. It's really important to understand that if you're going to peel more of this back.
Well, I didn't intend to make tax the subject. I was trying to point to the fact that we, in fact, voluntarily become U.S. citizens by our own actions. And it's not something that we were of birth. In other words, we weren't born that way, that we have voluntarily put ourselves into that position, and that people today have been so dumbed down by every source of information, including the pulpits, into believing that we're all U.S. citizens, and in fact, that's not something we were born as. That was really my point.
Yeah, and I agree with 100% on that one, and a corollary to this thing, too, Terry and I both agree on this, is that, we're not a nation. One of the things I try and think about is, why aren't more people active? What's holding a lot of people back? Is it fear? Is it lack of knowledge? What can I do? Education, is that what we need or whatever? And I think there's some mental blocks that have been built in our mind, and they've been planted there so successfully over our entire lifetimes that, they're kind of like we take them for granted, like gravity. They're just part of our makeup now, and we can't, most people can't even begin to get their minds around what's real. We are not a nation. This was the whole battle. We are a federation. And this was the whole battle, over the Civil War as well. We are not a nation. A nation implies, when you say we're a nation, then you accept the idea of a central government. a supreme sovereign government. That is not what we have. We have 50 states that are sovereigns. They are nations who have voluntarily agreed because of the people to work in a coordinated fashion for mutual defense and purposes of that nature. That's it. That's all that thing was there for. And I believe, like, we don't should not be pledging to a flag with a fringe on it. I think a lot of people agree to that. I furthermore believe that the Pledge of Allegiance, which was created by a socialist, it's been reworded, I think is part of the problem. I have said the pledge since I was, you know, could barely stand up, put hand over my heart and talk. You know, I've done that through every single day of my educational life, at least through 12th grade. And I proudly do it at meetings. I continue to do so. But I no longer say it the way that it was written and given to me. I say I pledge allegiance to the flag of these United States and to the republic for which they stand, one federation under God. And I don't use the word indivisible. One federation under God with liberty and justice for all.
Well, that's exactly what I put the word divisible in place of indivisible. I can say divisible with liberty and justice. And
I actually encourage the movement to think about this because I think that, you know, these words, they really are very important. And, you know, I think that that is a problem. Now, if you want to segue from there into the second topic, we can, but it's the same thing, that we have mental blocks because of words that have been built into our brain. That are being either misused or we have one definition, but they use a different definition or whatever. The same thing is going to apply when we start getting around to talking about this whole claim that, quote, Mexicans own, have a right to the southwest of the United States. So that's what we're going to talk about. And whenever you want to get started on that, we can.
Whenever you're ready to segue, I'm happy to go down that direction. You want to start us out now? You want to go there now?
Yeah, well, let me go ahead now because
Before you do that, let's see if Red, do you have an open mic? I know you've got an open mic on the switchboard, but have you unmuted yourself?
I just did.
Well, good. Say hello to our old friend Kurt McKenzie, and if you've got anything to comment about the first hour's discussion, now would be a good time before Kurt launches off into his other topic.
Well, you know, I'm just so happy that you were able to arrange to have Kirk back because when he's around, why, we've got some very good discussions and discussion points and this and that. And I just would like to say that when I came out of the service active duty in December of 52, that's quite a few years ago. I knew that our political system in this country was not going to survive the kind of mistakes that were being made. I could tell that there was a progression in process. There was something in process, and as over the years, as I watched it. I had my first confrontation with the IRS in 1957, and that, of course, was part of an education that has been with me to this day. And it took a couple of months, but I was able to back them off, and I had another confrontation in 63, and it took 2 years. And they were forced to back off in that case. But I saw the progression from 57 to 53, 63, I should say. And then, of course, I'm studying this thing, and I had never questioned what I had been taught in the public school. And it wasn't until I was about 40 years of age that I came to the conclusion that I had been mentally crippled Mentally disabled was the effort that had been put in my into my life. They were trying to disable me mentally with what I had been taught and what I was getting over the media, mostly radio at that time, and the newspapers. I would devour any newspaper that I would have access to, and I could see this progression. Then when they came in 73, 74, they were a terrorist organization, and nobody was talking about terrorist organizations. But as I look back, I can see where they were a terrorist organization in 1974, and I came to the conclusion that I was somebody. I kept saying, you know, over the years, I'd say, why doesn't somebody do something about this that's going on? And then it dawned on me that I was somebody, and I think Terry probably remembers the night we were on the air and somebody asked the question, I think, how come I got into this? I'm just an old Cat Skinner truck driver, rancher, farmer, construction worker. I worked construction superintendent, construction for jobs and one thing and another, whatever it took to make a living. And but I saw, when I was a superintendent on a construction job in 1962 in Yellowstone Park, we had an environmental, you know, he was on the sidelines watching what we do and did and made sure that we didn't trespass outside of the construction area with anything and all. And he was from Europe someplace. I don't remember now. I think he was from Belgium or Holland or someplace. He couldn't speak very good English. And I recognized that progression that was coming, and it was on a, I mean, it was just coming down. Now, I'm talking about a long time ago, 1962. That's, you know, that's 50 years almost. And it is, I guess. And anyway, that progression has come along up till today. And I'm very much aware of the arguments that we have heard tonight about the corporations, the federal zone, and all of that. I went through that 20, 25 years ago. And then I came to the conclusion 20, 25 years ago that this system that was just, you know, no end to their progression into a totalitarian type of situation, which we have today, I could see it happening. Now, I had grown up in church. I had back there in the 60s. I was a Sunday school teacher. I was a member of the church board and all of this kind of thing. And I came to the conclusion that we were on a course that was going to be end up with a disaster. But then, you know, we watched the USSR and how they operated. They murdered millions upon millions of people over there that didn't that they couldn't manipulate their minds as they wanted to and all, and they just eliminated them. And when they came into power in 1917, why they said the first thing they did just about, they put out a declaration: there is no Creator God. And I said in later years, then I remembered that, and I knew what was happening over there in the gulags. I had a cousin that was a B-17 pilot that was his plane was crippled and went down over Russian territory, and all nine of his crew they were able to parachute out, and they were taken by the Russians, and we've never been able to find out what happened to them. That there was thousands of them. Our people were lost over in that mess over there. and I came to the conclusion that the USSR could not survive because they were in violation of the First and Second Commandments. And in 1991, in December, USSR was dissolved. And look what has happened in Russia since that time. And these 22 or 23 years, look at what has happened. The international press and such are reporting and saying that Russia is now the moral compass for the people on planet Earth. We have lost that position. We had it for a long time. We've lost it. And we're going to see a day here. I think we're going to wake up some morning, and it'll probably be the same thing that happened in Russia. The Russian people woke up in December of 1991 and woke up and found their government had been dissolved. And I think that this government is going to, they're in such trouble right now. We have been able to just absolutely destroy the tax court in every single case where they've followed our advice, and this is something that we need to get out to our audience tonight. We've got to recognize, and we've got to, really get this planted in our brains, that in our minds, that the janitor in the federal building, the janitor in the town hall, the city hall, the janitor in the county courthouse, the janitor in the federal building, the state buildings, and all of the judges, whether it be a city court, a county court judge, a state court judge, or whatever, including the 9 justices of the U.S. Supreme Court. Every single one of them, every one of them, they are beneficiaries of the tax laws. And we have won quite a number of tax cases where, traffic cases, where people have applied this information and they confront the judge and the prosecutor with the fact that they are beneficiaries of the tax laws. They are beneficiaries of the fines they collect. And in most places, the fines they collect, they get a percentage of it into their retirement fund. And when you confront them with this fact and tell them, say, you cannot make a finding of fact or conclusion of law because you have a conflict of interest. And we are, I sued a federal judge in 1993, the senior federal judge in the state of Montana. A lawyer ran for Congress, set a couple of terms, or I don't remember how many terms he had in the U.S. Congress. Nixon appointed him to the federal bench. I sued him. I had filed 4 different actions naming the Internal Revenue Service, and all 4 of them I demanded a jury trial. All 4 of them were dismissed by that judge on motion from the Justice Department. They were summarily dismissed, and I never even got a hearing. That was a clear violation of Title 18, Section 241. I named that judge in that federal action. I filed it. It was a Title 42. That case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was docketed in August of 96. It hasn't been heard to this day, and it won't. The Solicitor General, who is the attorney in the Justice Department. I don't know where we're getting that feedback, but I don't like it. But anyway.
Well, we've got a caller with a hand up, Red.
Oh, well, let me just finish this, and then I'll shut up. The Solicitor General, who defends the government before all cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, 4 months after the case was docketed with the U.S. Supreme Court, the Solicitor General noticed all parties to the action that I was correct, and he was not going to oppose me. Now, this naming these people for their conflict of interest, they are beneficiaries of the tax laws. We the people wrote the Constitution, and we the people won that war of independence, or war the Revolutionary War. We wrote the Constitution. We wrote the Declaration of Independence. It was we the people that wrote Magna Carta back there in 1215. And we the people are still here. We're still here. And that's what's going to happen here in this country. I'm absolutely convinced of it. We're not going to solve it in the courts until we get enough people educated, re-educated, deprogrammed, and re-educated. And it is happening. Our audience today is a lot smarter today than the audience was when I would come on this program 3 years or so ago. And it's happening in this country, and I hope that we can do the same as they've done in Russia. Hopefully we can, and we'll see. I'll shut up and listen to the rest of this, but I want to thank you for getting Kirk on, because he's a very good guest, and I'm just glad he's there.
Thank you, Red. Before we launch into the other topic, let's take this one caller. Area code 484, you have an open mic. Did you have a question for our guest, Kirk McKenzie?
Yes, Terry. This is William Taylor Royal. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. William, how are you doing?
I'm doing fine. I listen with interest a lot to your programs. This one, no exception. I think there's some fundamental errors have been put forward, and maybe we need to dedicate a program to it, but the issue of the 14th Amendment creating the second class citizen or second type of citizen, and there's not United States citizens, I think you need to go back and read Federalist 51. James Madison makes this very clear that, and it quotes the following, in a single republic, all power surrendered by the people submitted to the administration of a single government. And the usurpations are guarded against by a division of the government into distinct and separate departments. In the compound Republic of America, the power surrendered by the people is first divided between two distinct governments, and then the portions allotted to each subdivided among distinct and separate departments. Hence, a dual security arises to the rights of the people. The different governments will control each other at the same time that each will be controlled by itself, end quote. There has always been two citizenships in this country, state, and because the state was a part of the Union, you're a United States of America citizen. If you're in the District of Columbia or any territory, then you're only a citizen of the United States of America. The original Constitution makes reference to citizens for president, for senator, representative, for charges between states.
William,
there have been a total misunderstanding with respect to the 14th Amendment. Now, you know, and we've talked about this at length, that the 14th Amendment was never approved or ratified lawfully, so it doesn't exist. But listen to what I've been told by a number of attorneys that the 14th Amendment is the new Constitution after the war between the states. And I think that's a fair conclusion, and at least that's how they're operating in one respect. But remember, in Article 1, Section 8 of the original Constitution, Clause 18, the implementing clause there, that's what Clause 18 is appropriate legislation. In
William,
the 14th Amendment, pardon me, yes?
William, what's your question for Kurt?
I'm trying to correct the understanding of what's been said here, Terry.
I'm not sure there's a conflict, though. I'm not sure there's a conflict.
There was.
We can address this on the show, but did in fact change a new class of citizenship, not for the people in D.C., not for the people in the territories, but for the citizens of the states.
It, Terry, I think I've studied this as extensively as the next guy. And the 14th Amendment was always intended to change the relationship as was originally intended to have the states, which are the only parties to the compact. The federal government is a result of it, and they are still clearly the people of the states, and therefore the states are superior to the central government. But the 14th Amendment changed that 180 degrees. But what the point I'm making is the persons referred to there has been broadly interpreted. And frankly, as I said, there have always been persons and people referred to in the Constitution, state and federal. The difference is that the original implementing clause of the legislative power of the federal government was perverted by, in fact, the whole government was perverted by the so-called 14th Amendment by intent. But look at the implementing clause, which was used in the 13th for the first time. It says Congress shall have power to enforce by appropriate legislation the provisions of this article. There
right.
is how they changed it. They did it not
believe,
by necessary.
I don't believe you and Kurt are in any differing opinion there. I think Kurt would agree with that. Kurt,
but
you want to make a comment? You want to make a comment back to William?
Yeah, actually, I disagree with William, but I think it's really a topic for another show. I think that Ms. William is not reading the Federalist correctly either. There were two different governments to protect the people. That did not mean that we were citizens of the federal government. But I really want to move on to this next part of our presentation, and I don't want to continue on this. So can we go ahead and do that?
All right.
Certainly.
William,
thanks for calling in.
Well, we'll talk later, Terry, and I hope I'll be on the show as a guest, and then we can discuss this more fully.
We can do that. Thank you very much. Okay, Kurt, go right ahead.
Okay, so I think that, you know, so the reason for this next session of this presentation is, you know, again, I'm struggling, you know, why aren't more people getting active? And those that are, you know, I think we're a little bit too tepid. I'm not quite clear, you know, what are all the reasons for that sometimes. And I'm talking about, you know, the movement at large. And so we're in the middle of this invasion. And it's been going on for a long time, and I think that this is really kind of crystallized and brought to the fore that, you know, there is a fundamental part of the bigger agenda. And, you know, people who understand Agenda 21, congratulations, you're on first base, but you got a long way to go. You know, this really taking over the country by demographics has really been a part of much bigger agenda, and you can see that it's coming to fruition. And I want to dispel... help people to argue back here, because what generally happens is when you start talking about these issues, people start using the word racist. You know, you're racist. And that's typically, you know, mainstream media, New York media basically, and so forth. And I really want to dispel this. So I want to get into this issue. Do the Mexicans have a legitimate claim to the southwest United States? You know, they're essentially claiming an area that includes California, Nevada, Utah, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, parts of, you know, in Texas, parts of Oklahoma. I mean, it's a huge area that they're claiming, and in some cases they're even saying Idaho and Oregon and Oklahoma and Kansas. So we're talking about a massive area. So I want to get into this question, because I think that we tend to buy into this stuff because we've heard it all our lives, and I think it's just completely bogus. So let me explain to this. First off, it gets back to words. I think a lot of people in the movement don't understand words. You know, when you say Mexican, what are you referring to? Mexican is not a race. If you said you're American, it has no reference to your race or your religion, your age or your sex. It just means that you're here in this federation. That's what it means. And the same thing is true of Mexican. It doesn't refer to a race. It's just somebody who's within, you know, part of the political system that's within the current boundaries. I am going to use the current boundaries of Mexico. I know there's historically been a bigger boundary, but the Mexicans we're talking about are people who are coming across the border. So I'm going to talk about the people that are inside of the present-day Mexican boundaries. Those are the Mexicans. And there are a lot of them that are white. There's blacks. There's people who are native. There are Spaniards. There's all kinds of people, different races. So let's dispel this notion that were engaged in this topic has anything to do with race. Mexican is not a race. In fact, I think when they try and get around to doing the stats on it, they consider them to be Caucasians. The so are they? Do they have a claim here? And the answer is, look, they come across the border. They're not native to the United States. I mean, that's just a fact. I mean, that's just the way it is. So they have no claim on that basis to say, hey, you know, we have any right, much less, you know, a right of citizenship, much less a right of owning all that land and taking that all over. The claim then it goes back to historical. Well, these were our lands a long time ago. Let's look at that, because that's also bogus. The people, Mexicans that are were indigenous, people who have been there for a long time. What are they? Look, they're Olmecs, Toltecs, you know, Zapotecs, Mayans, Aztecs. They're not Apaches and Navajo and so forth. The part that they're saying is theirs, they were never native to, indigenous to. That's a completely bogus statement. You basically have people who are descendants of Aztecs and Mayans saying that somehow they have some kind of claim to the land of the Navajo and the Arapaho and Apaches and so forth. It's all nonsense. So where does this whole other thing kind of come from? Well, let's get back to Mexico itself. Mexico was a country that's recent. I mean, Mexico didn't exist. You know, Spaniards came in and they took essentially what was a very fractured area, all kinds of different cultures, ethnicities, religious beliefs, and so forth, you know, just like they were in the plains, there was a lot of different people. And because the Spaniards came on in, to some extent, you could say they unified these people. But they're not, you know, have no historical unity. They're different people. And so the Mexico itself as a political entity did not exist historically. It became and was created, started with an insurgency on September 16th of 1810, and ended up with the Declaration of Independence of the Mexican Empire on September 28, 1821. So Mexico, as we know it, as a political entity, doesn't even start until 1821. That's something I think a lot of people lose track of. So then what happens is it's a dictatorship. Now, for a period of time, they actually tried to be something like, you know, we were here in the U.S. They tried to have a constitution and so forth. It didn't last. Basically, it was taken over by a dictator, General Antonio Lopez. They suspended the constitution in 1836. So what happens is the first step that occurs is that people who are now in present-day Texas, the people who are native to Texas, that includes, you know, people who have come in from Europe as well as whoever was there before, they basically say, look, we don't want to be part of a dictatorship. You know, these guys calling themselves emperors and, you know, they have all the control. And these aren't their lands. And so when Texas fought back, this was not a fight that was engaged on behalf of the United States. This was a fight of the people who actually lived there, and they weren't the only ones. There were two other areas in Mexico that revolted at the same time. They did not succeed, but Mexico did. Texas did. Texans were liberated from the monarchy they had been put under in 1821. And they only did this once the constitutional government itself was overthrown. So understand, Mexico was created by conquest. It's not some kind of, you know, original right. It's a conquest itself. And then it is true that then the United States, or Poppy, says, hey, wait a minute, we don't see any historical claim to these lands either. You know, you have conquered this land, said it belongs to you, but guess what? We think it belongs to us, and they went ahead and they beat them. They defeated them in 1848. And so the Treaty of Guadalupe Hidalgo, those lands now become part of the political entity known as the United States. And so we essentially out-conquered their conquest. I mean, there's nothing more to it. This is not a racist comment, and I have no problem engaging this in dialogue no problem being called these kind of names, because it's really not true. What we're really talking about here, and I think it's obvious to most Americans, look, they failed as a country. They had resources. They had water. They had timber. They had stuff. They failed. They started off wrong, and they failed. In the meantime, we up here in the northern, we did really well. We actually pursued a vision not of conquest. We didn't. When we defeated Mexico, we didn't conquer Mexico. We said, here's the dividing line. You guys have all that. We're not going to take that over. That's yours. So it wasn't. We didn't conquer the Mexicans. In fact, we didn't conquer the Mexicans at all because they were south of that border to begin with. We conquered the government that claimed that it had some right to lands up in the where the Plains Indians were. So we essentially then took over and control of those lands. Now, the real issue here is we succeeded, they failed, and they want part of the prosperity. Now, we as a country have been pretty open. We have been open more than any other country in the world that I can tell because of our religious background, our beliefs, whether you're religious anymore or not. I think most of these people in the movement have actually the principles that were established by Christianity. They may not be Christians, but those principles are what drive us. And so we built a nation based upon a different idea, an idea of liberation. And instead of conquest, I guess we could have some argument about that, we built. You know, we invented electricity. We built electric motors. We built diesel engines. We built cars, television sets, modern-day communications, computers, iPhones, you know, copy machines, printers, refrigerators, garbage disposals, indoor plumbing. We didn't invent it, but we made it in the rally. We have created the greatest prosperity for the greatest number in the history of humanity. We've lifted up hundreds of millions of people around the world. Not just here in the United States, but in China and Japan. I've heard some estimates 200 million Chinese have been lifted out of poverty because they're now riding on the American wave. So to feel any kind of guilt about this is really displaced. The reality is we're saying, hey, we'll let you in, and we'll acknowledge you, in my opinion, when you come, and you come and you become properly here, and you begin to work and you contribute and so forth. Look, you're part of the system. You come here legally, you work through the process, glad to have you on board. But when you come here illegally and violate these things, and furthermore then say, call us racist, and say that, you, by the way, this all that we have done is somehow yours, then we have a real problem. You know, this isn't dirt anymore. This is industries. These are resources. We invented it. We showed how to make trees into something and dirt. Look at what we made from dirt, silicon, all the basis for electronics is dirt. I mean, incredible productivity that we have created. So I think that the point I guess I'd like to convey to the people in the movement, do not have any hesitation in standing up and calling a spade. We have succeeded. We're willing to open the door and share that to people who come here illegally and who adopt our principles. If you come here for the money and then you sit there and say you want to overthrow this, no. I don't care whether you got here legally or not. That is treason. But if you come here illegally, it certainly has, there's no basis for you to sit here and make any kind of claim to what we've invented here. Don't go along with this whole racist thing. There's a difference between racism and nationalism. Nationalism, why do you form a nation? To protect your prosperity. You know, you create something. It's like you build a house. Well, why do you put locks on the doors? Because it's your house. You know, and you don't want people coming in. But we have people coming in saying, no, it's my house. You know, or first they come in and say, well, wait a minute, you know, your door should be unlocked. I need a place to stay. And then they say, well, gee, I want a bedroom. And now give me a bedroom, and now I want your whole house, and I want you to get out. I mean, there's no reason whatsoever, in my opinion, to feel bashful about getting into this discussion. And I hope that, you know, by pointing out some of the points that I'm making here tonight, that people will feel a little bit more emboldened to do so. And with that, I'll just kind of turn back over to you, Terry.
Well, don't go away here. We got about 25 more minutes to go, and there's a lot to discuss. Let me say this. We had a lady on our show a couple of years ago. Name's Alice Benson. She goes also by her Hispanic maiden name, I believe. It's either Ramirez or something like that. But she was extremely knowledgeable on this topic of Otzlan. I'm sure you've heard that term, Otzlan.
Yeah,
I think it's A-T-Z-L-A-N, which is different than Otzlan.
A-Z-T-L-A-N, yeah.
A-Z-T, yeah, Otzlan. I always pronounce that a little weird. But it is basically something that she brought out was that it had been fomented and promoted through the Jesuits working in conjunction with the Muslims in Mexico, which was a very fascinating point. I mean, that was it was really an eye-opener for me to hear this because, you know, we hear so much about how the banksters are really controlled by or work in conjunction with the Vatican and the Jesuits and the Black Pope and all of that. Well, she brought forward the fact that the Muslims were working in conjunction with the Jesuits in Mexico, and she brought forth proof of that. We should probably get her back on the show. I actually sent her an invitation and let her know about the show tonight, kind of hoping that she might call in because she lives right down on the she's of Hispanic descent herself and has lived for many years right down in Douglas, which is a town, I think, south of Tombstone, right on the Mexican border in Arizona, and had a lot of inside information. But we see today a lot of things going on where these people are really brought in and associated with the church down there, and they're brought across this border, and they're a part of that movement. So they've been part of who have fomented this idea to resurrect and to expand this idea that they have some kind of a claim on southwestern United States. So I think it's very appropriate that you've laid it out as far as the history of it precisely. What else did you want to share about that? I think it's important for the people, for American citizens, the citizens of our states in the southwestern United States, to have a good grasp on this. And frankly, when I've brought this topic up to people in Nevada and Arizona and Texas and California, most of them don't even know what the word Otzlan, they've never heard it before. And they're certainly, I mean, they maybe heard of La Raza. But basically, they're all dumbed down on this. They don't realize that there is truly an underground movement to conquer, to retake, by basically occupying the southwestern states.
Yeah, I'm not sure I buy this Muslim thing, Terry. You know, I'd have to hear this thing. I just, you know. But I think that the point you make is that it definitely is a movement. Let me give you some for instances of, you know, and we'll go beyond just the issue of Mexicans here a bit. But, you know, you have professors here in the University of California system that have been given jobs, and not being given jobs by Muslims, they're being given by the University of California system, and they're openly preaching this. They're openly saying, hey, we're going to overthrow this part of the country, and we're going to do it through population. This has been a plan for a long period of time. The five miles from me, there is a college, a local community college here. Since this is a high-tech area, this is more than just the normal community college. But they have evening classes for adults. And, you know, I had written the book on money, and one of the people who had been coming to my classes, a Hispanic kid, came over to buy my book one day, and I kind of engaged him why he wanted to have it get so quickly and so forth. Well, it turns out he was going to a class that night given by, quote, a respected teacher, and we talked a little bit about it. He says, well, the class is basically all these minorities. They bring in people from India, from China, from Mexico, whatever else. And the guy is basically teaching them, don't do business with whites. You're basically what they're trying to say is everybody else, you know, you have this word minority, which is baloney. I mean, minority refers to 2 billion Chinese, 2 billion Indians. I mean, you know, 90 million Mexicans or whatever. I mean, it's a joke. But it's us versus them is the thing that's being created. And when they say minority and they say, you know, civil rights and all that stuff, the unhidden word that they don't say because it would sound racist is to say, well, what they're doing is discriminating against whites. It's minority. And they're actually here actively promoting the idea that all of these cultures should come together and work to defeat, quote, the light in this country. And whether it's happening or not, you can see it actually in the election results. I mean, you take a look at the election results for the last presidential election, 92% of blacks, something like 85% of Mexicans, people from China, something like 70-some-odd percent. I mean, you know, they're voting en masse. And so I think that it is definitely a reality. I don't believe – I believe this comes from New York City directly. I do not buy the Muslim thing. But it's definitely part of the whole thing. And I think what I'm trying to, you know, suggest to people, because this is an issue where we're uncomfortable talking about it. We know if we talk about it, we're going to be called racist and all that. No, it's nationalism. We're talking about nationalism. We're talking about the fact we built a house, and this is our house. You know, we didn't conquer your house. You have your house. You screwed it up. You got all that going on down there, blaming all of us for it. But the bottom line is, you didn't succeed. We did, and you want not only your cut, but you want to take it over. And I think that we should be very forthright and non-defensive in talking about this particular topic, particularly as we are seeing this issue really brought to the fore. That's why I've actually wanted to talk about it tonight, simply because it's a current topic. But it's an old agenda that's been around for quite a long time.
Yeah, I agree. And I'll be glad to put you in touch with Alice and let you guys go neck to neck. But she was basically, she brought forth evidence that showed that there was literally a conspiracy. There was actually the church, the Jesuits were conspiring with the Muslims. And she pointed out certain events and who was backing those events and what was being taught at those events, some of the literature that was coming out of those events. I mean, she tied it together pretty well, but I don't, you know, you don't have the background in that at this point, so it's understandable for you to question it. We will correct that. I'll get in touch with her and get the evidence for you. We've got about 16 or 17 minutes left in the show. Do you want to continue on this topic, or do you want to talk about something else?
Well, maybe let me kind of take a different topic, but actually continue the main theme here. So, you know, what I've been recently trying to do, Terry, you know, I've been working on Defend Rural America, and I came to that as a strategy because I think that the last stand is going to be the heartland. And so, therefore, you have to become engaged, understand what those issues are and how to fight them back. So, while we have the global perspective, we have to understand the local issues and how to fight those back. And so I've kind of pretty much laid that out. The thing that I don't see is I still don't think that people really understand how serious the situation is, and because I don't see the sense of urgency. If I think people truly understood, if they really understood what's going on, they'd be far more numerous and they'd be far more aggressive in taking back their local county supervisors and sheriffs and so forth. And I don't mean conquer them, in a sense of defeating them, but I'm always talking about a constitutional approach. And so to that extent, I'm sitting there thinking, geez, what's holding it back? So I think part is this idea that we're a nation. Part of it is that we're afraid to confront this issue because we get called racist and so forth. Oh, my God, we're worried about that. We don't want to offend people because that's our culture. You know, we don't want to offend people. Well, I think part of trying to convey to people how serious the situation is, I've kind of taken a divergence. You know, I know a lot of stuff, and you, Terry, you and I have talked. We both know a lot. And there's time for everything. And so I finally determined it's time to put some other parts of the agenda on the table and to try and convey to the public at large, hey, look, things are seriously off track here, and in hopes that people will begin to understand just how off track they are. And so to that extent, I've recently written some white papers. They're actually kind of photographic essays. They're meant to be very little written material, mostly photographs, that debunk, you know, there's no question that 9/11 was an inside, was an inside job. There is absolutely no question. I study that for months. I think I know about every detail having to do with that. But I try to synthesize just a few of the key photographs and put the words around it I've done the same thing with Pearl Harbor, and I have done the same thing recently with the Boston Marathon. These are all false flags, and I think that the hope is that when people use their own eyes and look at the photographs and look at them in the context of just a very few words that kind of challenge this. I think we get so programmed by TV. We sit there, you know, we've had a long day or we've been busy, we want our minds to rest. Our minds go into neutral. And therefore, whatever appears on TV goes right into our brains. We think it doesn't, but it does, and particularly if it comes to three or four channels without realizing that all channels come from New York City through the Rockefeller Center. So we just get programmed, and we turn our critical reasoning off. So the idea was to go ahead and present just very simple, just take a look at these, make your own opinions, just look at the photographs, read the little bit of wording that goes along with them, and make your own decision. And I believe that what people who may not heretofore have looked at this seriously or have even considered this a possibility or dismissed it, I think in a few minutes can actually prove to themselves that either if they don't agree with my conclusion entirely, they're going to start to think, because there's no way you can look at these photographs and begin to adopt the official position. So those are available. I have for a long time put out something I call Citizens Newswire. I've done it through email. I've never made them available through the web. I've had lots of requests to do that, but I've been busy with Defend Rural America and building all the website for that, so I haven't done it. So what I've done is I've now took a step back, trying to bring in challenge people on some different issues to, again, try and help them wake up, get organized, get active, become effective, have a strategy, focus, all those good things I've been preaching. And so I am building out a citizensnewswire.org. It's just now being born, so it has come back later. It's under development signs. But there are a couple pages that are there now. So there is a white paper for 9/11, and there is one for the Boston bombings, and there will be one for Pearl Harbor here before much longer, and I may do a couple more. I mean, you know, you can go back to the sinking of the Maine about the Spanish-American War. You can go back to World War I and take a look at the assassination of Archduke Ferdinand and everything that led up that. You can take a look at what instigated World War II and getting us into it through Pearl Harbor. You can look at Vietnam. You can look at Korean War. Again and again and again, what you see is they're playing us. They're playing us big time because we allow ourselves to get drawn into this. So I'm trying to awaken people up to these issues, maybe with the idea of hoping to convey to them that things are a little more serious than they might imagine, and they really need to get serious and start taking serious action to turn things around, or we're going to lose it.
Well, amen to that. And, you know, in the promo that I put out before the show tonight, you click on either the words author or publisher or activist. There's also some other links underneath where the picture of Kirk is and where it says Defend Rural America. Underneath that, there is some Citizens Newswire links there as well. And so our listeners can access, if you got my email promo, you have a number of those different ways of reaching some of Kirk's material.
I appreciate you doing that, Terry, and that's probably the best way for them to get that information. They're free. You can go there. You can download the white papers, and it's a PDF file, and I think that they're four or five pages, and they're basically almost all photographs. You'll very quickly either think I'm nuts or you'll have a mind-altering experience.
Well, we've all had those moments where I have to, you know, I've admitted many times on this show that 6 or 7 years ago, I had red, white, and blue fever. And there was a lot of things that I thought were ridiculous or propaganda or whatever back then. That and I've had a lot of these light bulb moments in the last 6 or 7 years where I had to admit, okay, well, I was wrong on that one. And when you look at the evidence with an open eye and you start seeing the lies that are being told, it's just like you talked about with the television set. I've now gotten so conditioned to knowing that they're lying on the television set that it doesn't matter what they say, I look for the lie in it. I know there's a lie there. I mean, it goes without saying that, you know, 90% of what they say on the screen has a lie in it. And if you look for it and you start doing your research on it, you'll break that dumbing down conditioning that where you just, you know, become numb when you're watching it. And what it really makes you do ultimately is turn the thing off, because you get so disgusted when you start realizing how many lies are being told and how much misinformation and disinformation is being put out on it. You can't really sit there and watch it very long without your attitude kind of going south on you and you starting to get angry. So it basically brought me to a point where I watch television maybe 5% of what I used to watch.
I'm with you. I don't hardly watch it. You know, I'm with you 100%, Terry. Let me take another whack. Let's take a shot at Hollywood, which is just an extension of New York City. Let's take a movie, Avatar. You've seen the movie Avatar, right?
Well, I already knew enough about it, but I've seen parts of it.
I'm just going to use that to build it. Maybe a lot of people who've listened, you know, it's a story about they kind of step into these machines and they kind of become part of these big native people that are much bigger, stronger, and so forth. And it's a wonderful movie. I mean, you watch this thing and your heart gets into it and so forth. But if you really digest it down to its simple points, what is it? The bad guys are white male capitalists, and the good guys are trees that talk to each other, and natives, and they've used a characterization as between a combination of Mexican and Asian. Anybody that's minority will see themselves in basically the native folks there. So it's essentially, without saying it, the subtle context of this thing is white male military capitalism is destroying Mother Nature. And wantonly so, and destroying and displacing the peoples and so forth. And, the right way to live is somehow sleeping in trees, and that you can roll up in a leaf and it'll keep you warm at night, and you don't have to worry about the wolves and the tigers eating you, and you don't need the farm either, because somehow the magic of the fruit will all be there. And so you can kind of gently walk along without it touching a leaf or destroying anything, and the trees all talk to one another, and they create a consciousness. It's if you really peel back the story, I mean, it's a wonderful story. But the message is so subtle, but it's there. It's like Chocolat was another one. If you really start to look at the movie in the context of what they're communicating to you, and to the kids and everybody else, it's quite remarkable, and normally these Hollywood movies will be tied to what's going on in the politics of the day. They're coordinated.
Yes, indeed. Red, any final comments that you wanted to contribute here? Once he gets his mic unmuted. We're not hearing you yet, Red. Uh-oh. He cut himself off trying to unmute. Well, Red, maybe you'll call back in, and maybe you won't. Is there anyone else? We've got quite a few callers that have called in to listen tonight, but not too many have raised their hands. And I don't see any new questions in our chat room, although we've got a few folks there also. Kurt, you've spent a lot of time on these false science stuff and the propaganda that's been coming out of this, I guess we can still call it government. It's really not. It's really a usurpation and an occupation of our republic by a foreign entity. But what's happening on that front today? How do you see that being stopped? You know, they're attacking water, they're attacking the grouse, they're attacking the fisheries, they're attacking a lot of small businesses, they're trying to steal the rights using Aboriginal rights and anything they can lay their hands on. Do you see that that's escalated? Do you see that there's victories happening out there? What do you see?
Well, you know, they're never going to give up, so it's not like we ever get a win, but what we always get is we get losses, and the reason is we play by the rules. You know, we'll put up a fight, but, you know, it's like football. If you lose the down or you lose the game, you stop fighting. That's our typical response. They never stop fighting. They have a strategy. They know where everything fits and everything has to happen, and they'll never give up on anything. So the best you can get is to kind of hold them off. Now, we're still holding them off on the dams up in Siskiyou County. There's a massive fight up in Montana right now over the Western Watershed. We have the Bundy Ranch, of course, that everybody is familiar with. That we won around, but that won't be over. And we lost one in the Drake's Bay Oyster Farm. You know, that whole story, they closed down just a few days ago. They had to shut the doors. They lost. And that is a mammoth issue, because there were really some significant constitutional issues in that, and let me give you a crux of that in a second. But at the same time that they're shutting down oysters here, guess what? The very same departments are saying, oh, the oysters are a savior, they're cleaning bays elsewhere, and in fact they're now promoting oysters in other bays, and I set out a story that, on that as well. There is no science. It's completely made up fraudulent. There's plenty of examples on the Defend Rural America website. There is an absolute battle, just as there was in the Soviet Union when Russia was overthrown, to take over all the natural resources and basically abolish private property and public land, and to turn all back into centrally controlled land, and the people therefore just become serfs. In fact, slaves under the Federal Reserve System were essentially nothing more than slaves. So it's a huge battle. The in our nation, the only last productive sector, really. I mean, we've given up everything, even guitars. My God, they forced Gibson Guitar to give up its guitar business almost. They said that all your craftsmanship has to be shipped offshore because you have to bring in assembled parts. You can't just bring in raw lumber anymore. Of course, that's not true of us. We can export raw lumber, and that's what they do. They buy raw lumber for us. But, you know, it's a huge battle that's going on right now. And so if you really want to understand what it's going to take to win back our country in the heartland, you have to then understand neo-environmentalism, the Endangered Species Act, the National Environmental Policy Act, the Clean Waters Act, the takeover resources, the Indian tribes, all of that stuff has to be understood, because those are the weapons that are being used there. In the cities, it's going to be more of your typical Agenda 21 and ICLEI and stack and pack and get rid of transportation and get rid of your cars and put you all on bicycles and control you and put you in little tiny isolated communities that can't communicate with each other, where you won't have free travel and so forth. But rural America has a particular set of battles that have to be fought, and I think that I guess what I would say, Terry, is that the fight's on. I would say that the fundamental issues are being more and more understood through efforts like yours, like mine, and others to get these topics on the table, so that people get off those couches, get outside their comfort level, and get up and get going. And I think if that's where it's at, I know that, we had multiple, I think we're up to 9 states in the West that are basically trying to, one way or another, coordinate and cooperate and communicate and put together some plans to keep our resources from being stolen from us by China and so forth. You know, for those who are familiar with the Bundy Ranch situation, the whole deal was that there are some rare mineral earths there, and Harry Reid sold it to China and wanted them. I think that was your last week's show. You know, they wanted those, and so that was the whole deal. It had nothing to do with the tortoises or anything else. But basically they're saying there's a new constitution, and that constitution is neo-environmentalism. They're using a new way to try and convince us that really we should destroy our forests, our dams, our energy supplies. We should destroy ourselves, essentially, and feel good about it, because we're doing good for the earth. It's a crock. So anyway, the fight's on, Terry. That's all I can say, and I think that we need more people to get up, get active, get organized, and get educated and fight back.
Well, we are out of time, Kurt, as usual. You've been a great guest. Really appreciate you a lot, and let's plan some more shows and keep educating the people. Next week, we're going to be talking about allodial tidal, which is going to be a very, very interesting show, and I hope you'll you'll tune in, call in. Welcome to join that conversation. So thank you very much, and we will be back next week with Walls in Our Minds. And since Dr. Kate's not here, I don't have a I'll just play anything I can find here. Good night, everyone. Good night. Thanks much, Kirk.
Good night. Thanks, Terry.